Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. I'm Darren Hefty along with my brother Brian, broadcasting live following the Ag PhD What Your Fertilizer Dealer Won't Tell You workshop. So we're talking fertility again. Imagine that, talking fertilizer and talking about how we can save some money and make a better return on investment with any of our fertilizer inputs that we're putting out there. We're broadcasting from the Morton Center at the Ag PhD Field Day site today. We go on the road tomorrow. You can check out our full schedule of workshops at agphd.com. Just click on the events tab and you can pre-register there. We'll be in Rochester, Minnesota and Bloomington, Illinois tomorrow. So it should be a fun day coming up. All right, we're taking live questions from our audience. This is the way we do it at a lot of our workshops. When we get a chance to broadcast a radio show right from the workshops, we've got an audience in front of us. They've got a lot of questions. They just had to make it through a whole day of listening to Brian and me. And certainly at the end of the day, there are a lot of questions. And so we'll get to those. Do we have a question right off the bat here? Yep, we got one. Let's start there.
I just had a question. Where does boron come from if it's leachable?
That's a great question. Where does boron come from if it's leachable? I mean, it's an element that's in our environment. I'm not sure exactly where.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be in plants. It's going to be in just about all living things. And so just think about, for any of these plants, okay, so you might say, well, you know, if it's leachable, then it should just disappear pretty soon. But think about your crop that you just raised. Okay, and if there is residue on the soil surface, there's going to be some degree of boron in there. And as that breaks down out of that crop, then it's going to release for future crops too. So that's part of the reason why we talk about what it gets pulled off with grain and what's left in the stover. And there's for all these nutrients, there is definitely some left in the stover. And don't forget, the stover is not only above ground, but also below ground too. But yeah, there's boron, and I don't know what the level is in the atmosphere or anything like that, but there's definitely boron in plants, and I mean, there's some around. So anyway, yeah, there's some out there, but you got to think about, hey, if we're trying to get to higher yield levels and we continue to deplete our soil of boron, there's probably still going to be some there, but your plant's going to starve on boron. And when you start starving on any one nutrient, that can cause problems with other nutrients. Like we talk often about sulfur and nitrogen. If you're short on sulfur, it takes more nitrogen to produce the same yield. Okay, well, I don't want to spend more money on nitrogen. Sulfur is pretty inexpensive. I don't need much. I only need a little bit of sulfur, and that makes a lot. That makes the nitrogen I have much more efficiently used in the plant. Same kind of deal with boron. All right. Yep, ready for our next question. Yeah, go ahead, sir.
We got our lime on last fall, but we didn't get it worked in.
Okay.
We're going to have a problem.
All right. How much lime did you put on, by the way? Just roughly? A couple tons? 5 tons? A couple tons?
No, it was light.
Light. Okay. So here's the whole thing. We've looked at this for a long time, and there are many universities that have also, because there are so many people in the United States that want to go to no-till or strip-till now. Well, they don't want to work the ground at all. And so they ask, well, can I put lime on, and is that going to work? So we've done some of this work too, and what we found is it does move down in time. It's just it takes often 2 to 3 times longer to get that soil pH change that you would like. So what we generally advise people to do that don't want to till in their lime is you got to be thinking ahead. So in other words, if you're in an area of the country that, you know, let's say your pH is continually dropping, you're using lots of nitrogen, all these things to keep forcing the nitrogen or the pH down. If you see, boy, my tests, it used to say 6.5, then it was saying 6.2, now it's saying 6, we're heading down. I got to be ahead of the game a little bit. I can't wait till the day that I need. I'm now at 5.5 and I want to get it to 6.3 tomorrow. It's not going to happen. But in your example of, okay, I put it on last fall, just a couple of tons. Am I going to get benefit out of that this year? You'll probably get a little benefit out of it this year. You're going to get a lot more the following year. So it's nothing to worry about. I wouldn't get panicky about it. If you say, boy, my pH is 4.7 and I'm going to have a disastrous yield unless I get my pH up, then I would tell you, boy, if there's some way we can work it in, great. But if your pH is upper fives or you're close to where you need to be, it's no big deal. I won't worry about it that much. You'll be fine. Okay, you bet. Thanks. All right, let's get to the next question.
We've been doing weekly tissue samples on our corn through the
yep.
summer.
Okay, awesome.
Through Midwest Labs. When they come back like soil tests with a high, medium, low, and a value. Are the values that Midwest gives you what you think are sufficient? Or we don't know what values are Here, like the soil tests. You
okay.
know,
we don't. So I think it was Randy Dowdy that probably said this to us the first time, or we heard him say this in a meeting. So I'll give him credit for this. But he goes, yeah, I started sending samples into a lab for a tissue analysis, and I started getting results back, and they said sufficient. And so I called the lab, not knowing. He goes, I'm a first-generation farmer. And he said, yeah, you say it's sufficient on here. Does that mean it's sufficient for 200 bushel corn, or is it sufficient for 300 bushel corn, or is it sufficient for 400 bushel corn? And the lab said, well, we really don't know. It's the average of all the samples that have come in, so we call it sufficient if it's the average. If it's below average compared to others, then we'll call it deficient. If you're above kind of the average level that others have, you know, for all our tests we send in, then we're going to call that high. And he goes, well, let's just think about this for a second. Who actually sends samples into your lab? And they go, well, we don't have a lot of people that regularly test. A lot of people will just send us samples when they have a problem. So he goes, oh, so what you're saying is I'm sufficient compared to all the other people that have problems. Well, maybe. So that's the big challenge that we got here, and that's the challenge that all of us as farmers have. There's no established database in our country that we know of, other than, you know, some of these high-yield farmers are doing it on a very small scale, to say, all right, how many nutrients do we actually need at each stage in that plant at this particular nutrient or at this particular yield level? We don't really know. So what a lot of the high-yield guys end up saying is, well, just create your own database, and if nothing else, you say, okay, I raised 250 bushel corn this year, and I got all my levels, so I know now that for next year, I got to be at least at those levels to get 250 bushel corn. And my pushback on that is always, you know, that's not really the way I've learned agronomy. The way I've learned agronomy is at any stage in the plant, there's usually only one limiting factor. So in other words, maybe all my nutrients could be slightly lower, but one of them is the key. Which one is that? I don't know, because we don't have a big enough database yet. So I wish I could give you a great answer to your question, but that's kind of where we're at.
Listening to Ag PhD Radio, we're broadcasting live and taking live questions here following the Ag PhD What Your Fertilizer Dealer Won't Tell You workshop. We'll be right back after this.
In 1949, Morton Buildings constructed our first machine storage building to establish our bond with the farming community. Since then, our relationship has grown, and so have our product offerings. From the smallest specialized operation to the largest agricultural enterprise, we understand the needs of your business and continue to evolve to meet industry demands. Plus, when you build a Morton building, you're backed by the strongest warranty in the business. To learn more about the Morton Advantage, visit us online at mortonbuildings.com.
Clean fields and higher yields start with a strong battle plan. For soybean growers, there's no stronger ally than Sonic herbicide. When applied pre-emerge, Sonic has proven to defeat yield robbers like water hemp, mare's tail, and giant ragweed. With long-lasting residual control, it keeps fighting to defend your field from invaders. Visit battleweeds.com to plan your attack against weeds. Always read and follow label directions.
Sir, yes, sir!
When looking for someone to help with your risk management, a key component to look for is patience. Patience to bring you along in the process at your own speed. Patience to learn about your operation, and patience to not only discuss what strategies may be effective for your plan, but why they would be effective. That's the strength of Grain PhD. I'm Darren Hefty. When you're ready to become more engaged in your risk management, Grain PhD can assist you with that process. Visit grainphd.com to learn more.
In farming, getting things done early has a way of setting you up for success. Like using Corvus for an early season win over weeds. Corvus keeps even the toughest weeds from gaining a foothold. Multiple sites of action deliver superior control of emerged weeds. And later, Corvus reactivates with just a half inch of rain to take out any new weeds that may have sprouted. So get an early season win against weeds with Corvus for end of season rewards. Always read and follow label instructions. Corvus is a restricted use pesticide.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. We are live at the Morton Center after a workshop that we did today called What Your Fertilizer Dealer Won't Tell You. We talked a lot about soil fertility today. It was a lot of fun. And what we're doing now is taking questions from our audience. And when we get to you, if you wouldn't mind, please just say your first name and maybe the state that you're from. That would help us out. And then go ahead with your question. So we're starting over here. Okay, go ahead.
Gino from Minnesota, and my question is on lime again.
Yep.
With strip-till machines, have you guys ever tried putting lime on with one, or if there's any effectiveness in it? I know it wouldn't be very efficient because of the ability to blow on large amounts, but...
Okay, so it's a great question. Basically, we have not done that on our farm, and I'll tell you the reason why we haven't. There are some people who, in rented ground, have done a little bit of that, and you certainly can. Because if you say, well, I'm in 30-inch rows, I may not use what's in the middle of the row, and I might only have this ground 1 year, I don't want to spend all that money on lime. You have two ways to handle that in my book. Well, three ways. Number one, you could do nothing, hope for the best. Number two is you could band it, and that's a pretty good choice, and then you aren't going to put so many dollars out there, and you aren't going to leave so much for the future. But then the third choice is you could just go to the landlord and say, you know what, I'd like to either have a long-term contract, or all this lime isn't going to come available. We need it. You can see the soil test. Can we split this? Or if I lose the ground, could I get a percentage of the money back and the next person pays for it or something like that? But anyway, part of the reason why we don't usually talk about it that way is lime is a soil amendment, not a fertilizer. So here's what I mean by that. We want the pH of the soil to be a little bit better, in part because it's not just about feeding the crop right now. It's about getting nutrients more available all through that soil in the future, and it's also about your overall soil health. So we talked today about, yeah, fixing pH, and that's important. What we didn't talk a lot about is your soil microbes don't love a 4.7 pH. Okay, they want that pH more into that sixes range, and you just have better beneficial life in the soil.
Oh, everything's good. You break down herbicides faster. You break or timely, I should say. You break down residue better. And, I mean, there's a number of things that are going to be better.
And the other thing with this is, if let's say your ground was low on calcium, and that's part of the reason you're putting this lime out there. Okay, think about just your compaction you're creating with your wheels that are going in between the rows. We know we have more compaction when we don't have adequate calcium levels. So I'm just trying to say calcium has many other benefits besides it being a fertilizer for the crop. And so that's why we almost never talk about banding lime, but some people have done that. I would just caution you on this too. If you're doing it, don't get very carried away on the rate. It doesn't take a lot if you're just in a little area. And, you know, we have run into a lot of guys, even ourselves, where we over-lime, and now we create a problem either raising the pH too much or tying up some nutrients that we really didn't want to tie up. So just use it in moderation.
Thanks, okay. Gino.
All right, let's get to our next question here.
Nolan from Nebraska. On your dry boron that you were using.
Yep.
What kind of a product exactly were you getting? If you're getting 3 pounds actual,
yep.
I mean 20 pounds broadcast, that can get pretty wild. Were you getting some kind of a homogeneous mixture with a bunch of other stuff? Or?
Okay, so this is a great question. There are a lot of different ways to do this boron thing. What I would suggest to you, rather than taking a straight boron product and mixing it with other products, is either buy something like you suggested, a homogeneous one. We've done that before. You can buy some of those products, dry products, from different companies where it's a little bit of boron, some calcium, some manganese, you know, a bunch of different nutrients. And that's great because every pellet has a little bit of boron. What we ended up doing now, so we did some of that earlier. Well, now we're down to the fact that boron's about the only thing we need on some of this ground. So literally, we had somebody this fall just running out there with a fertilizer spreader and nothing but boron in there. And it just had the ability, we have the ability to, number one, go variable rate, and number two, run with low rates and still get a nice even spread. But our biggest fear with boron is if, let's say, you need 10 pounds, 20 pounds, whatever it is, you blend that in with some other fertilizer, and either that boron shakes down to the bottom or it rises to the top, and what happens in your field? Well, you got 1 acre that's dead and the other 99 acres that don't have any boron out there, so now we got a real problem. So anyway, the product we ended up getting was a 15% dry, and we were just spreading it by itself here this fall. Okay.
Let's take one in the back here.
Yeah, Marion from Nebraska. Okay, if you're doing foliar tests several times during the year and Midwest keeps sending it back saying you're short on things like boron and manganese and copper and so forth,
yep.
Are there some foliar products you put out there that the plant will not take in on those things? Will they accept will a foliate pick up copper, boron, manganese?
Yeah, we can we can do a pretty good job.
Copper, boron, and manganese, yes.
Yeah, with most nutrients, we can do a pretty decent job with foliar apps. You can certainly do Y-drop type applications, too, if you have enough moisture to drive them into the root system, and if they're nutrients other than zinc and phosphorus and potassium that will move down into your root system. The other thing is we're finding better luck just in our recent testing with fulvic acid mixed with those nutrients foliar to try to drive them in a little better. That's what we're doing in our farm. Not saying that's going to be the best thing in the world for everybody. I haven't got enough data to do that, but for us in our farm, that's what we do. Okay, another question over here.
About three questions, Doug, from Nebraska.
Only three?
Yep.
For now.
The agronomist took care of the rest of them.
Oh, awesome.
You guys were talking about safe for next year's crops. And what about, is there a rating for chemicals that are safe for next year's crop on alfalfa?
Sure.
And where would a guy find that? Or is it right on the label? Or how many
right on
days?
The label, they'll have crop rotational restrictions. And that'll give you a good place to start in terms of how many months ahead of planting that crop. But then you've got to use some common sense. Let's just say you got 2012 all over again. You got no rain all summer. I'd add another year to everything that they recommended. Or you may say, you know what? It's a 12-month rotation. I want to plant in 11, but I've had tons of rain. I've got this great soil. It's been breaking down great. I got tremendous microbial activity. That might be, you know, I can't recommend it because it'd be off-label. But if you said, boy, it's going to be borderline, I would side to think that you're going to be on the safe side in that kind of situation.
It just seems like some people, since they haven't planted a lot of alfalfa for a lot of years, are having a tough time getting started. And I think a lot of it comes back to pH, organic matter, maybe fertility, stuff like that. But the other deal was, if pH is so important, and I know that there's companies or people that will sell a pH meter, however much money you want to spend, why don't we do our own pH testing? Is that something that is too expensive if that's that important?
Well, pH isn't going to move this huge amount on you unless you're making great big soil amendment applications. I mean, unless you're putting lime out there or elemental sulfur or something like that, it's not going to move very much. So if you've got an idea and you say, well, my soil testing program is to pull a sample every 3 years on this ground, I think you're going to be good enough with that. But if you said, you know, I've got an issue with, or I'm going to go with alfalfa in this field, what I would do is for your rotation before that alfalfa is going to go in, that's the fields that I'd want to have sampled. That way, I mean, because you're only putting alfalfa in, what, every fourth year or something like that, or you're hoping the stand's going to last that long. Then I'd find where that ground's going to be that's going to be alfalfa, and I'd make sure my pH is up.
But my question was towards, if you get to 1 acre samples, you know, you're going to have to do a lot of sampling.
Yep.
The other thing is, the way you guys say the most important thing on a soil test, you know, you start with pH first. Why don't we format that first things first, second, third, fourth on the soil test?
The tricky part is, let's just say, let's go back to your pH meter. Let's say you could go out and pH sample instantly on each acre. So you're going to go out, every 1 acre, I'm going to write down what my pH is in those spots. You don't really know what the problem is. You know what I mean? Because is it that I've got super high amounts of sodium? Is it that I've got super high amounts of magnesium? Is it, you know, what's out of balance? I don't know. So I do like to see the complete soil analysis. But, yeah, the arrangement of how things are on the soil test, that would be a smart move. So, yeah, someday down the road when you've got your own lab, Doug, definitely. You put your things just right in the order that you want to look at them. It's kind of like your phone. I mean, if you've got a smartphone on your home screen, you arrange things into, well, hey, I use this a lot, so I'm going to put it on my home screen. You could do the same thing. I agree with you. I think that would be an awesome idea. I think it's great. Now, we're broadcasting live from the Morton Center here at the Ag PhD Field Day site. We're right at the tail end of our What Your Fertilizer Dealer Won't Tell You workshop. It's pretty fun. We're getting questions from our crowd. We'll be right back after this.
One year it could be moisture stress, another Pythium or nematodes. So you need your soybeans to rise ready for whatever the season holds. Now one simple decision provides coverage on four fronts. The Acceleron portfolio, fungicides, insecticides, bioenhancers, and an industry-leading nematicide that strikes where nematodes attack. This season, rise stronger with Acceleron seed treatment products. Learn more at acceleronsas.com/riseready. Performance may vary. It's important to use proper PPE when handling treated seed.
Want to cut production costs without losing yield? Brian Ryberg from Buffalo Lake, Minnesota has done just that. Here's his story.
We began using a soil warrior on our farm fall of 2014. We've seen many benefits from better water infiltration, a lot less hours on equipment, fuel, able to reduce our fertilizer side. So it's really simplified our operation.
See what makes Soil Warrior different and better at soilwarrior.com.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, mare's tail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor herbicide brands. Always read and follow label directions. Your grain bin fans can cost you a lot. High electric bills from running when conditions are not ideal, shrinkage from overdried grain, and spoiled grain all take money out of your pocket. With the Steps GMS app temperature humidity switch, get your bin fans to start making you money. Only run vans when the conditions are right. Eliminate shrink and spoilage in your bins. Deliver grain in top condition at market moisture. When every dollar counts, you need Steps GMS. Contact us today at stepsgms.com.
For over a year, I've been butchering the scripts for the Farmer's Edge ads on my podcast. But hey, it's not my fault. Honestly, they offer too much stuff. On-farm weather stations, that little plastic data transfer thingy they shove in your tractor's port, daily satellite imagery, their integrated farm management software, soil sampling, variable rate technology, it goes on and on and on. And they expect me to do that in one ad. That's why I just say Farmer's Edge. It's a company developed by an agronomist to help make you a better farmer.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Vellum is Rotem North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Vellum. For more information, visit vellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Center at the Ag PhD Field Day site, just wrapping up the Ag PhD workshop called What Your Fertilizer Dealer Won't Tell You, and we're taking questions from the audience. Go ahead.
Dan from Nebraska. When you're strip tilling, say your corn, you're putting that band, trying to keep it all concentrated area. The next year, do you stay in that, go straight down the same row? Or do you split rows, or how do you guys do it?
You know, there are some people that do that where they're in, say, a corn and soybean rotation, and they'll have a strip that they build just for corn, and they'll always put corn in that same strip. They have a strip that they'll use for soybeans and always put soybeans in the same strip. I think it's better to vary, and I realize there are some benefits each way, but to me, if I put soybeans in that same exact spot, I'm just thinking, I think I'm inviting problems with disease, with bugs, with other things. So for me, I like moving around a little bit on a year-to-year basis. And the other benefit of moving around is now you can drive on last year's stalks. You can run tillage where last year's wheels were and trying to break up that compaction. That's my strategy. What do you think, Brian?
Well, what we do on the farm is we're typically just splitting it. Now, we might be right at 15 inches over, but over time, we usually don't go all the way back 15 inches. We might go back 12 or 11 or something like that. Sometimes there might still be some residue there or something, and so we're not always – up, we're on 30-inch centers, now we're 15 over, the next year we're right back to it. No, we do vary it a little bit over time. I would tell you this, too. We did a study years ago when we first started strip tilling because I got worried. We have a lot of rolling hills here, and it's like, well, what's the drag that we're going to have on this machine and on the planter and everything else? Because we got RTK, and so theoretically, we'll plant right over the top of it. But I'm like, realistically, that doesn't happen all the time. So I said, how far off the row can we be and we still maximize yield? And what we found is if we were within about 5 inches of where we'd place that fertilizer, we were in good shape. But we did some stuff literally 15 inches over, so as far over as you can be, and we dug root pits then later, and we found that the roots actually moved to where those zones were. Now, we lost a little bit of yield, not much, but the point is the roots take – roots are – I always tell people, roots are dumb. They don't know where to go. They don't know where you placed your fertilizer. Roots are dumb. Okay, they just take the path of least resistance. Think about a lot of us in life, you know, or you, whatever. So I've got kids, and you give your kids a hard time. Oh, you're just taking the easy way out. That's literally what the plant roots do. They take the easy way out. But what they do is when they hit an area that has decent fertility, then they'll really proliferate right there. So we've shown this like behind glass where we'll have a band of starter fertilizer and all little scraggly roots, and around where the fertilizer was, man, there are all kinds of roots right there. So anyway, my whole point with this thing is you want to be relatively close with that fertilizer, and if you are, we're in good shape. And also, what I like about strip till is we have zero compaction all the way down to that depth. A lot of times we're trying to get down 8-10 inches deep, but even if it was 6 inches deep, that's better than nothing. And in a lot of ground around here where we'd done tillage years ago and lots of it, we had a pretty heavy compaction layer at 4 inches, 5 inches, something like that. At least we're getting below a lot of that stuff. Do you have a follow-up to that? Okay. All right, go ahead, sir.
Rick from South Dakota. Last fall, we didn't get a chance to empty out all of our hog winter pits.
Yep.
So we're going to have to do it this spring because we'll run out of room. Normally, we knife it in. Would we be better off spraying it, going over top, and incorporating it in? Or if we knife it in, do we have a chance if how long do you have to wait before you can plant?
How deep are you going to knife it in?
We're knifing it in about 5 inches.
Yeah, okay. So, again, I kind of come back to how dry is that ground going to be? If it's going to – right, exactly. You don't know. I don't know.
Now,
nobody knows.
Now, Rick's been putting in tile and been working on drainage down in his area. So, hopefully – I mean, I would assume the ground you're going to get into first is going to be tiled ground.
But anyway, the whole thing is – if we can get in there early enough, would I still like to inject it down at 5 inches? You bet I would. Because if you lay it on the soil surface and you work it in, there's still going to be some virtually at the soil surface. Now, my guess is, and I could be wrong here, but my guess is if you've had livestock for a long time, the top 6 inches in your soil is probably built up pretty well. Mm-hmm. We don't need, and especially the top couple inches, we don't need to load that top couple inches with more fertilizer. So if I could, I'd like to see that ground dry out, and I would prefer to knife it in. Now, you talk about how much and, you know, could it potentially hurt plants? Yes, it could. So I got to be thinking about that more in the spring than the fall, obviously. So if it's me, and I know this is more work, but I try to get it out over more acres and keep the rate low, or maybe your rate's low already, I don't know. But anyway, that's one of the things you might want to talk to an agronomist, or, you know, you can give us more details later or something. But, you know, let's talk about how many nutrients we actually have, how much salt we actually have, and what's happening with that. But I would say this, I like the 5-inch idea, because now you got it down at least, you know, you should be at least 3 inches below where that seed is. So I'm going to hope that we're going to be okay, unless you're not getting real excessive on rates. Okay.
Let's take another question here.
Yeah, good afternoon, David from Minnesota. You talked about the soil pH per inch in today's presentation.
Yep.
For a no-till or a minimum-till farmer, how often would you recommend to go to a conventional tillage practice to stir the soil and blend?
You know, that's a touchy one right there, because there are definitely some no-till enthusiasts that would say, well, never. I don't ever want to till again. I'm never doing that. It's terrible. It's the worst thing in the world. I'd rather use cover crops to do any kind of movement of nutrients or breakup of deep compaction and those kinds of things. So you can certainly do whatever you want to do on your farm. What we were talking about, and Brian just pulled up a graph for those of you who
are on page 15
in the audience today, but for those of you who are at home, what the graph shows is we took three different fields, three different farmers. One farmer does strip till, one farmer does...
Well, two different farmers, three different fields.
One farmer does conventional till and the other no-till. And then we looked at each 1 inch as we went down in the top 12 inches of soil, what the soil pH was. And what was interesting, in the top couple inches, it was around the mid-sixes. By the time we're down about 6 inches deep, it's down to 5.2. But then when we get down to 12 inches, on average across those three different systems, it was back up to 6.3. So we were talking about, well, what would you want to do with that? And would you want to do some tillage out there to try and stir things up? And we'd also talked about nutrient stratification and those kinds of things. So, yeah, that's a good question. We just said, let's just look at something out of the box here and say, you know what, maybe every so many years you just say, hey, I've got issues out here. I'm going to do some tillage and try to even things out, clean things up, and then start over. Now, and one way you may do the tillage is you may do something deep if you've got a compaction layer that 10 years of no-till and cover crops just hasn't broken up, okay, go in with an iron solution, break it up, and then move on and start over.
All right, now let me give you the contrarian view.
Never known to go against any idea that I would have.
Seriously, though, this is one of the things that our dad told us growing up is you should be able to think about both sides of every argument. Okay, you got to consider the other factors. All right, let's say that we do that. What's necessarily wrong with having a little zone in your field that is down into the mid-fives? Because what did we talk about? What's the advantage to the mid-fives? What is the advantage? Well, what did we say? We have more availability of some of the micronutrients. So I don't know. It might be a benefit. It might not. Because there's nobody I know ever that's done this kind of testing. I've never anybody ever do this.
So maybe in that 4 to 8 inch profile in your root system that you're taking in a lot of the micros.
I don't know.
Maybe you're pulling in all kinds of manganese at that area of the root, and you're not pulling any in the top, even though there's just as much in the soil.
Yep. So you'll notice when we went to this chart, we didn't say, okay, you have to fix this, and here's how you're going to fix it, and here's why it's causing you a problem. We just said, well, here's the data.
Well, and the fun
we don't really know.
The fun thing, too, is to make observations with anything in farming of, oh, I noticed this. You know, all my best cows have ears that have this shape. Okay, that's a strange observation, but maybe you look at another herd and you say, wow, their best cows also have that shape of ears. You know, that's something strange. Maybe you look at
that's
this and say,
my best thing I've ever heard come out of your mouth,
awesome.
Darren, and I've
point
heard a
well
lot.
Taken. Point well taken. Now, let's look at your soils, and maybe you do need an acidic zone at some point, or maybe you do need a higher pH zone. We don't know, but when we throw things like this up against the wall, we've got this broad audience. I don't know how many states were represented here today at the meeting. It was a lot. And a lot of people with different backgrounds. Somebody might say, well, you know, this is why that happens. Or, you know, this is the good thing that happens there. This is the challenge. And a lot of times we do get that by talking to farmers elsewhere who are also looking at crazy
things
we believe like the shape of their cattle's ears.
And we believe this happened because a majority of the roots are down in that 6-inch kind of range and they kick out lots of acid. So that probably did lower that pH. But could there be a benefit to that? I don't know for sure.
All right, we'll get back with more interesting questions like that right after this. Stay tuned.
Your independent spirit is more rewarding than ever before. Unlike incentive programs that require growers to purchase a particular seed brand or to bundle certain products, the FMC Freedom Pass program rewards you for making the best choices for your fields. You decide what's best for your operation, from pre-plant to harvest. Your retailer and FMC take care of the rest. It's really that simple. The exclusive agronomic rewards, performance assurances, application innovations, and product financing of the FMC Freedom Pass program make it easier to protect your crops and cash flow. That's what we mean when we say we give you more freedom in the field. You'll experience more control and confidence too. Generics and imitators can't promise that. Visit your authorized FMC retailer or FMCFreedomPass.com to calculate your potential financial incentive and learn more.
For over a year, I've been butchering the scripts for the Farmer's Edge ads on my podcast. But hey, it's not my fault. Honestly, they offer too much stuff. On-farm weather stations, that little plastic data transfer thingy they shove in your tractor's port, daily satellite imagery, their integrated farm management software, soil sampling, variable rate technology, it goes on and on and on. And they expect me to do that in one ad. That's why I just say Farmer's Edge. It's a company developed by an agronomist to help make you a better farmer.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, marestail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor herbicide brands. Always read and follow label directions.
In farming, there's a lot of variables out of our control. Don't let fertility be one of them. Let the experts at AgroLiquid move you closer to your bullseye. It's true. AgroLiquid fertilizers are formulated to keep nutrients available to your crop, and they have unmatched compatibility with other nutrients and crop protection products, which makes application more efficient than ever. But we also have the best people in the field, ready to talk about your operation, your goals. Go to agroliquid.com to move you closer to your target.
We started utilizing the Dual React system this year. You can adjust your speed and it automatically adjusts your sprayer tips so you can slow down and you aren't building up huge droplets, or you can speed up and you're not throwing a mist that's drifting.
Hypro, helping you spray better.
Interested in strip tillage? You should know about the Soil Warrior from ETS. With one-pass efficiency, optimized nutrient placement, and reduced production costs for higher profitability, the Soil Warrior brings the future to your farm. Visit SoilWarrior.com to learn more.
Welcome back. Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. We're broadcasting from the Morton Center here at the Ag PhD Field Day site. We have a lot of workshops here throughout the year, and today's was titled, What Your Fertilizer Dealer Won't Tell You. We're talking about some of the extra stuff that you may need to know to help make more money and get a better return on investment with your fertilizer applications on your farm. Let's get back to our questions here.
Yep, over there.
Go ahead, sir. Chris from South Dakota. You've showed a lot of different grid sizes today and different sample desks.
Yep.
I'm guessing, what is your preference for a grid size and sample depth for the most consistent samples?
Okay, well, you threw out one of my least favorite words in agriculture, and that was consistent. It's rare when we find anything on the farm that gives us a consistent return or turns out consistently equal, but I'll just say we have done a lot of things to your point. We're to the point now where we're pulling primarily 6-inch soil tests, but you can do 8, you can do 4, you can do 12. That's kind of your call, but we kind of like the 6.
Yeah, and it depends on what you're doing. So let's say you're doing strip till, yep, and you're putting a lot of the nutrients down in the 8-inch to 10-inch profile. Well, a 6-inch sample is kind of worthless to you. So you have to vary it a little bit, yep, depending on what your practices are and what your crops are.
Yep. So if I was putting a bunch of fertilizer down at 8 inches deep, then I'd be pulling at least an 8-inch core and maybe just 12. Okay. In terms of what grid size to run, we have a lot of variance here in this room. I had some people say, well, boy, you should be doing this EC testing, electrical conductivity, run a Varis machine and set up zones. I'm like, well, we've done some of that. You know, it's okay. Well, 5-acre grid's right, 10-acre grid's right, 2.5-acre grid's right. I'm to the point where now on our farm, at least a couple times, I want to get 1-acre grids, just a couple times. I'm not saying we have to do it forever. But what we found is even in our 5-acre grids, we've had a fair amount of variance. But you got to keep in mind, what's our ground like? You look, just look out the window of the windows of the Morton Center here. You see we got a lot of rolling hills. Okay, there's a lot of variance in 5 acres. Okay, maybe on your farm there isn't that variance. But what I tell guys is, let's prove it at least. At least, even if it's just take a couple of your 5-acre grids or even a couple of your 10-acre grids, whatever you're currently doing, and just go all the way down to 1 acre. And if you can say, you know what, they're all about the same, then you're on the right grid size. If you say, oh my goodness, that's different, well, then you're not. And our problem, and like I was explaining here today, we got ourselves into trouble in part because we overlined because we were dumb and didn't think that we thought the line was done breaking down. But two, our grids were too big. And if we're going to lime and we're going to spend money based on what the grid test tells us, I want to make sure it's right, or at least as close to right as possible. And with our variance here, to me, in the short term, it will pay doing a few 1-acre grids, okay? So, yeah, I mean, I just, whatever your current program is, I'd stay with that for right now. But on a small scale, let's try a little bit of something else and just see and prove it out. That's why we did in the same field, 10-acre, 5-acre, 2.5-acre, and zone, all in the same. It's only a 60-acre field. It wasn't going to break us either way. But we're like, let's just find out and see. And once we saw the variance there, it's like, huh, maybe we need to go with smaller grids for right now. And the other thing that I threw out today to the audience is I said my dream someday is that we can measure all these things as we cross the field. So like one of the questions we had earlier is about testing soil pH all the time. Is it expensive if you were going to test it yourself? No, it's just what's the accuracy of some of those things in the test that you can run yourself? Okay, so what I'm hoping for long term is we got some machine, like literally could be right in our sprayer boom or whatever, and as we're crossing the field, it can sense all these things and we can change on the go. Just think how that would affect our yield. It'd be awesome. And we'd only spend the money where we need to spend it.
All right, let's take another question here.
I'm Eric from Iowa, and I got hit really, really bad with the gall midges.
Ooh, yes. Okay.
What is my option? Go all corn?
Yep.
Well, that's your best option. That's 100% control of soybean gall midge, just not planting soybeans. The other option, we had another gentleman here, Delaney, he was saying that he planted his soybeans first, and they were up first, and man, did he get hit with soybean gall midge worse than his neighbors. He thought late planting might be a benefit, but of course you're giving up yield doing that too. So at this point with soybean gall midge larvae, this is an insect where the midge or the little fly early spring will pierce into a small soybean plant stem, lay its eggs inside. The eggs hatch. They become little worms or larvae inside that stem, and they basically eat out the stem and kill the soybean plant. It's worse on fields that were continuous soybeans. It's worse right next to last year's soybean stubble because that's where we believe they're overwintering, and then they're just moving over into that new field of soybeans when they emerge. So at this point, there's no great control method. We've tried a lot of different things so far with farmers who have had this issue and haven't had a lot of promise. We don't have insecticides that are systemic enough to move through the plant that are labeled and control the pest. Foliar applications trying to kill the adult flies before they can lay their eggs have been ineffective. It appears you'd have to be out there constantly trying to get them for a few weeks or in the early spring. So yeah, we don't have good things yet at this point to report to you, unfortunately. Yeah, crop rotation is probably your best thing. Rotate away from soybeans and maybe keep the soybean fields away from keep this year's soybean fields long away from where there were soybeans last year, which is pretty much impossible. So especially in Iowa when half the ground is soybeans. Yeah, I don't have a good answer for you yet. We're learning more about the bug. The entomologists are working to understand their life cycle to see where the weak point is or where we can get after them. But at this point, it's very much like wheat stem sawfly is out in Montana and western North Dakota. There aren't any great answers for the problem.
All right, let's take our next question. Yep, go ahead, sir.
Joe Dietz, Traverse County, Minnesota. I want to go back to boron.
Yep.
I got all kinds of questions, but number one is I've had in my mind the last 3 years. I was here to one of your field days, and one of your top soybean guys out here was kind of telling me that every time he sprays, he puts a little boron in his spray because he said it's like the lifeblood of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thoughts on that? Is it better than going out and putting 3 pounds on the field?
Well, that particular grower's got very light soils and gets a lot of moisture. And in that situation, yeah, it's probably better than putting on a big dose. Where we're at, we don't get much rain normally, and we've got heavy soils with high organic matter levels, so we can actually hold boron pretty well in our soils. That particular grower you're talking about doesn't feel like he can hold the boron. It leaches out on him before the crop can use it. So he's putting it out in small doses to kind of put it out as the crop needs it. To eliminate loss or reduce loss and get more into the plant.
We talked today about putting some dry boron on in part because we look at the cost. And for all things in agriculture, you know, it's great if it increases yield. But at the end of the day, we got to make money. And so we just started basically today comparing a little bit, okay, what's liquid cost versus what's dry cost. Now, it's fine if we're just going to run very small amounts, then I don't have any issue with that. And we're doing that too. We're putting some small amounts on at least a couple times during the growing season. That's fine. But also, if your soil is really short, that tells us, you know, when we're going to go out and do some foliar feeding, yeah, we're going to get a little bit into the plant right then. But next week what happens. You're not going to want to go out there every single week. You know, we work with a lot of specialty crop growers, too, who literally go spray every week or every few days. Well, they can afford it when they got thousands of dollars of an acre coming in. We can't afford to go do that. So we got to look at, all right, what can I do to kind of build my soil up? And then at the critical times, when my plant really needs lots of boron, we'll just supplement with a little bit more foliar. You know, that seems a little more workable to us. But it's going to vary, to Darren's point, you know, depends on your area, your soil type, and you just got to try some stuff.
There aren't a lot of always and never type statements here either. And when we say we're dramatically short, normally going with the dry and getting a higher concentration at a lower price is a good deal. When we need the nutrients now for this crop, a chelated liquid is almost always the best choice. So there's kind of a balance there, and I think you could talk to liquid fertilizer companies, and they'll say, you know what, there are some opportunities here where you should probably put a dry on your farm, and there's some other spots where our liquid is going to be a much better return on investment for you. What Brian's just saying on this boron thing, heavy soils where you're at, you got pretty heavy soils, chances are you may want to put some dry on and then supplement with liquid during the season. Taking lots of questions here at the Ag PhD, What's Your Fertilizer Dealer Won't Tell You workshop. Sorry, I'm just struggling here, Brian. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
White mold, sudden death syndrome, root rot. If you raise soybeans, it may seem like you have all the cards stacked against you when it comes to disease. But did you know there is a new cost-effective seed treatment which can help prevent all three? Heads Up Seed Treatment offers a new proactive approach for dealing with fungal and bacterial diseases. Compatible with other seed treatments, hedge your bet against disease this spring. Ask your dealer for Heads Up today. To locate a dealer, visit headsupst.com.
No secrets here. We all know, regardless of the markets, balanced crop nutrition pays. Agro Liquid Fertilizers have the research, technology, and products you need to grow a great crop. We also have an outstanding team of field agronomists ready to help you determine the best use of your fertilizer dollar. Agro Liquid can help you maximize your yield potential effectively and economically. Visit agroliquid.com to find a dealer near you.
High-yield corn growers know that feeding the crop and soil are keys to maximizing yield potential. Nutec's EDA and Reverb are specifically formulated to help manage limiting factors associated with today's farming conditions. Nutec's EDA works within the plant to support nutrient mobility and utilization. Reverb focuses on the soil, providing beneficial trace elements which help condition the root zone for optimal microbial activity. Low use rates and superb tank mix compatibility make Nutec's EDA and Reverb no-brainers in the high-yield grower toolbox.
Clean fields and higher yields start with a strong battle plan. For soybean growers, there's no stronger ally than Sonic herbicide. When applied pre-emerge, Sonic has proven to defeat yield robbers like water hemp, mare's tail, and giant ragweed. With long-lasting residual control, it keeps fighting to defend your field from invaders. Visit battleweeds.com to plan your attack against weeds. Always read and follow label directions.
Sir, yes, sir!
Worried about glyphosate-resistant weeds and grasses in your corn? Unleash the power of new Impact Z herbicide and get the early post-application advantage you've been waiting for. Save $3 per acre when you combine Impact Z with a qualifying insecticide purchase. Go to buy2save3.com for details. Buy2save3 is a service mark, and Impact Z is a trademark owned by Ambac Chemical Corporation. All rights reserved. Impact Z is a restricted-use pesticide. Always read and follow label instructions.
Want to turn smart agronomics into smart economics? Go with the all-new Grow Smart Rewards program. 1. Start with a smart agronomic plan. 2. Qualify with the purchase of a participating BASF herbicide. 3. Earn $1+ per acre for each qualifying pair-up brand. Plus, you may qualify for an additional $75 per gallon back on our industry-leading fungicides. For full program details, go to growsmartrewards.com. Grow smart with BASF.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. We are broadcasting live at the tail end here of an Ag PhD workshop today. If you're interested in coming to one of our workshops this winter, you can check out all of our events at agphd.com. Just click on the events tab and you can pre-register there as well. Let's take our next question from the audience here.
This is Mike from Iowa. What do you think of
liquid calcium in furrow versus Pell Lime broadcast on rented ground?
Either one has some potential for you. I guess you can look at what the cost would be, but either of those forms can work and can help your crop for this year.
Yeah, but we know what the cost is. The Pell Lime's ridiculously high compared to the calcium in furrow, right? That's why you're asking the question. So it kind of goes back to what we talked about before.
Remember that field that we had sampled 10-acre grids, then 5-acre grids, and then we saw that top strip really needed it. So the year before I got lime out there on the whole field, I went with liquid calcium right in the furrow, and we had great luck with that. I use Liberate Calcium or Liberate CA. I used a liquid, I used a quart, I used 2 quarts, I used a gallon. I tried a bunch of different rates just to see what I could learn, because here's a low pH spot, why not do some trial work? And I think it was a quart that we ended up using that ended up getting us the best return on investment. I don't think we gained enough by doing my crazy excessive rates to justify the additional cost. But yeah, I had good luck with that. That's what I would do.
But two things about that. Number one, like we talked about earlier, we're not really fixing the whole soil. We're not making the soil healthier, all those kind of things. So if it's me, I'm probably still going to go back to the landlord and try to work something out so I can put regular lime on and get the whole ground fixed. The second thing is, I appreciated what Darren said there. He did a trial on that ground. Well, do you remember what that soil test said? We had some spots of 8. Did we really need the calcium there? Maybe, maybe not. Some people will argue, so I know we have Dick Goff on the show occasionally. Soils expert, he's fantastic, used to be with Midwest Labs. But he'll talk about even sometimes in high pH soils, we might still have some shortage on calcium. So if you're only running with a very small rate, like he's talking about a quart. Okay, a quart's not going to hurt even if it was high pH and we had ample calcium available. But sometimes you learn some things by doing that, just kind of like we do all the time, trying things out. Where I'm going with this is you might say, you know what, I can make a prescription map for my planter. We've done things like that where it turns on, you know, in the low pH ground and turns off in the high pH ground. I might do that, but I also would at least experiment a little bit even in the high pH ground and see, you know what, does a quart of calcium, could that possibly help me? Maybe it will, I don't know. In the low pH ground, I feel extremely confident it will help. In the high pH ground, it actually has a chance. So just some things for you to think about. I still don't love the idea, but if you say, boy, the landlord just won't work with me, I'm renting the ground, I'm absolutely going to figure out a way to band and not spend all that money. Because, yeah, if you start putting a whole bunch of Pell Lime out there, it just costs a lot of dollars, and you know that the next guy is going to get a lot more benefit out of it than you.
All right, let's take the next question here.
John from Minnesota. You were talking about dry boron before.
Yep.
Wondering what crop, corn or soybeans, that would work better in front of, and how about some of the other micros like copper and manganese? Zinc, I would assume corn, but...
You know what? All of our crops need those micronutrients, and so we're trying to get up to what our desired levels are regardless of crop. So we spread on corn ground and on soybean ground. If we're short in something, we're going for it. With the 3 pounds of boron, did we do that on anything other than corn ground, Brian, this year? Okay, we did it on soybean ground as well. So we started off, Brian was really excited about this, so guess where we tried it out on? Brian's ground. And it worked, and he had really good yields. In fact, I think it might have been the best yielding stuff we had. It's like, wow, we finally had a whole year where we never saw boron be deficient in a tissue test all throughout the year. So that was pretty exciting, and that's what got us going on this.
Yeah, in 2017, we had really good corn there. But anyway, I just pulled this up, and this is in your book too. Or for those of you listening at home, you can go to the Ag PhD Fertilizer Removal app if you would like a better answer to his exact question there on these nutrients and which crop should we really try them in. So I've got corn here, and then I can also look at soybeans. It's in your book. Or again, take a look at the app. But anyway, if you look at, let's say, soybeans. Okay, if I'm going to have 100 bushel soybeans, and I realize you might go, oh my goodness, I'm not raising 100 bushels. You might in a spot on your farm, so at least think about your highest yielding spot. But here's the thing. Copper, you only need 0.15 grand total pounds. So It's not so much that I need copper for the copper and just I got to have that in the plant. I want you to think about the disease tolerance that helps you with. And so sometimes guys want 2, 3, 4 times the normal level of copper for disease tolerance. And the other thing is seed coat elasticity. We talked about that today. If you're having problems with the seed coats falling off,
it's not just
try
that,
bumping your copper.
Even
rates.
Standability. I mean, when you think about
true.
Copper and manganese, when you're short in those, just like with potassium, if we run short of those nutrients, we end up having standability issues and stalk rigidity issues. So just think about that. I think it's important to get them out there.
Okay, let me read you these numbers quick. So grand total, 100 bushel beans need 0.15 pounds of copper, 1 pound of manganese, 0.62 pounds of zinc, 0.7 pounds of boron, and 3 pounds of 3 pounds of iron. Okay, then you get to 300 bushel corn. That needs 0.22 pounds of copper, not a whole lot different than the beans, 2.47 pounds on manganese, 0.77 pounds of zinc, 0.8 pounds of boron, and 1.2 pounds of iron. So you tell me, you know, when you start looking at this, you know, you said zinc, okay, you think a lot more about it in corn. Again, 0.77 on 300 bushel corn, but 100 bushel beans, I need 0.62. It's actually not all that much different. So,
yeah, and I think about this with 100 bushel soybeans. That's 5.5 pounds of micros that you need. 5.5 pounds. That's a lot. How much are you putting out there? A quart of a blended product? That's what a lot of guys are doing, if they're doing anything at all. This year, I've heard a lot of guys say, well, I'm not putting any micros out this year. I got to cut costs. I'm like, well, how much were you spending on them? $100? Well, no, I was spending $5. Why on earth would you cut $5 worth of micros out of your budget? Don't you think you can find some money somewhere else to cut out? It's crazy. And you think about it, we're removing, you know, several pounds of micros here in a 2-year corn bean rotation, but we're hardly putting any out there. So we're going backwards all the time. That's why these levels are so low. We just haven't put enough out there for a whole generation or more.
All right, let's get to the next question.
We variable rate. I'm Jackson, Bill Touche from Jackson, Minnesota.
Okay.
We variable rated MAP on our ground this fall.
Uh-huh.
And then it laid there for probably 5 to 6 weeks. I was getting concerned about it that, you know, if we're not going to get this stuff worked in. So I called our area extension people, and they said basically they felt the nitrogen component of that product was gone. Do you agree with that?
And you had some rain, you had some moisture.
Wait a second, though. How many pounds did you put on just roughly? What was your average?
Probably 350, 400.
Okay, and what did you say it was, DAP or MAP?
MAP.
MAP, okay. So 11 times even 400, you got 44 pounds of nitrogen. Am I that worried about 44 pounds of nitrogen disappearing, especially when it started in the ammonium form? Maybe. How late did you apply it? Was it October? Was it November?
It was the end of October, and then we never got it worked in until right after Thanksgiving.
Yep. How many days have we had above 50 degrees since then?
We didn't, I don't think.
Right, exactly. Am I that worried about losing all that nitrogen? No. Did we lose some? Probably.
Yep.
How much did we lose? Yeah, that's really, quite frankly, anybody's guess. If I was counting on it and I said, all right, I'm starting with 44, how much do I think I have left? You can say what you think, Darren. I think you probably still have 3/4 of it left.
I was going to say you probably have 20 pounds of it left. So.
Okay, so 20 to 30 pounds left, that's our guess. Okay. Yeah, we don't think you lost it all. It's possible. But I don't think you did.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other thing is, what were you putting it on for? You're probably putting that on for phosphorus. That's what you're varying the rate on out in the field. So, yeah, in some areas there was hardly any, and they got put on. And it really wasn't something that you were, you know, targeting as, hey, this is the biggest thing. I've got to get some nitrogen fertilizer out here to make a difference for this year's crop.
Hey, before we wrap up, I was just going to say we've got some workshops coming up here around the country, and we're calling them 101 Ways to Cut Expenses on the Farm Today. Everybody wants to talk about cutting expenses. Now, we're going to talk through some weed control things, a little bit on fertility, just a number of good things on the farm So it's not just all about cutting expenses, but it's about just better overall agronomic management. Love to have you attend those tomorrow. Darren's going to be in Rochester, Minnesota. I'm going to be in Bloomington, Illinois. Love to have you at those. We're also going to be in Gilbert, Arizona, much warmer next Monday. So really looking forward to that one in particular. But anyway, you can go to agphd.com to register for any of those and to find out what our upcoming schedule is.
Well, I want to say thanks to everybody who came to our workshop today. Thanks to everybody who's listening to our radio show today and everyone who asked questions here today as well. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.